All right, so this is lesson 19, in case you're keeping up with that, of church history. And last time we closed, we're in Thyatira, which extends out to about 1000 AD. And we closed last time just kind of with a lot of the dirt, and it was just, believe me, it was just the high point. A lot of the dirt of the papacy, and I know that some maybe wonder, you know, why we go into that. It's because that it's not gone into anywhere. And I know that, you know, you hear things and, you know, no hope in the Pope and all that kind of stuff. You go and you wonder, you know, well, why somebody makes such a big deal and why there's somebody, oh, you know, Bryce always complained about the Catholic Church, and all that kind of stuff. And there's a reason why, and it's because it's worse than people know. I'm telling you, folks, that when you start reading about the popes and you get down to the truth of it, there was never a viler, more debauched sequence of men that actually sat in a seat and called themselves the Vicar of Christ. There's never been a vile, I mean, when you get set up kings and all that kind of stuff, you get into vileness because they can do whatever they want to do. But in all seriousness, the papacy has bred some of the lowest, most debauched creatures, inhuman, inhumane, the whole thing, that have ever lived. And so we covered a little bit about of that last time, and I know that, you know, again, maybe somebody comes in and just thinks, well, it just can't be quite that bad. Well, yeah, it can be. It can be worse. Might be worse than you know. But anyway, so we're up into you know, the 500 to 1000 AD time frame. Now in Thyatira, we've covered a lot of stuff already. And what kind of follows tonight, it's going to be more like a genuine history lecture. I'm not sure how, you know, if it'll take more than this week or not, but the point is, with this, it's not to try to just throw a whole bunch of different kings and a whole bunch of different political scenarios and all that kind of stuff at you. The idea here is that the popes, you know, in Rome, when the Roman Empire fell in 476, I'm talking here about the imperial territorial Roman Empire. It fell in 476. And so the popes, from that point, you know, had to figure out how to do something else, because they were no longer the you know, they were no longer the best of the best, the top dog. And so what follows here, the reason I'm going into the politics of what, you know, some of the stuff that happened, is that so you can see how we got from the imperial, you know, the territorial Roman Empire to what is now sometimes called the Holy Roman Empire, because those popes had to maneuver and manipulate themselves away and into other situations that they could exploit. And of course, if you have any knowledge at all of the Dark Ages, you know that they managed very well. In fact, it was almost like they were inspired on how to do it. And so you might think about who led them, who gave them the wisdom. I mean, if these guys are so totally debauched and wicked, you know, who were they being led by? And I think you'll find some answers in reading Revelation 2 and 3, or you read about the seat of Satan and the synagogues of Satan and stuff. And so that's kind of what we're talking about here. So let's just kind of roll back a little bit, and let me just take a, you know, a swift survey through some general history. And I want you to see in all this how the popes manipulated the situation to get where they are. So in 476 AD, Rome falls to a Germanic tribe, tribal king named Odoacer. And he ruled there for a few years until Theodoric, the Ostrogothic king. We talked about the Ostrogoths, how they came down from north of the Black Sea and came down into Italy. Well, Theodoric the Ostrogoth defeated Odoacer, and this is around the late 400s, the early 500s, and he ruled from a place called Ravenna in Italy. up until 526. So now you're up in the early 500s. So the papacy has now been robbed. They are no longer part of the Roman Empire because there is no proper Roman Empire. It's you know, kind of cracked and gone into splinters and stuff. And so the papacy is now having to bootlick and apple polish the Gothic tribesmen, the Gothic barbarians that are now kind of running Italy. And so they've got to try to figure out how to do that. So the Pope wannabes are all squabbling, bribing. They're still, you know, we talked about simony. They're buying the office and all those things, and they're going about their corrupt lives, but they're also trying to figure out how to gain more power. So generally, the popes were elected by the clergy, and then Theodoric, the Ostrogothic king, would confirm and approve him for now. Theodoric dies, and the Ostrogothic kingdom kind of collapsed there in Italy. And in about 535, and again, I'm buzzing through this, and if you need dates or something repeated, let me know. But Italy was conquered then by Justinian, who was the emperor over in Byzantium, who was in Constantinople. So, as you remember, Constantine moved the Imperial Roman Empire capital from Rome over to Constantinople back in the 300s, right? And so now suddenly the Roman Empire, with Rome being scattered and the Roman Empire being scattered, remember that the Pope is now in one of the chief cities of the world, Rome. So he's enjoyed the increase of his power and all that kind of stuff because Rome was so highly regarded as an Italian city. So now he's falling again under the power and authority of the emperor in Constantinople as long as he's in power. And the popes had a cow because the emperor in Constantinople thought that the holy sees, now S-E-E-S, like the power and control, that the holy sees of Constantinople and Rome were equivalent in power. And the Pope can't have that, because he got to be the chief head honcho alpha dog. So that's what he's having to deal with. In 568, so again, mid-500s, some other barbarians called the Longobards or Lombards, one control in Italy, and one control in Italy, and Byzantium, the emperor in Constantinople, lost in partial control, and so the Pope started trying to figure out how to get along with the Longobards. Under these Longobards, the cities and villages and homes and churches were being pillaged and plundered because, after all, these guys are barbarians. Well, along comes a guy that's famous in Catholic Church history as Gregory the First. He's also known as Gregory the Great. He wasn't, but that was his name. And he is now thought to be one of the best popes to ever sit in the papal chair. He and Leo the First are big deals. He was kind of a moral monastic, not just a thief in priest garb. He was known, though, for his missionary zeal, whatever that means for a Catholic, which means going in and, you know, defeating other people and forcing them to get baptized as Catholics. But he was had a burden for missions, and that's what Catholic missions are. He's also a great administrator. And so the historians say that his great work was expanding the power of the Roman bishop, okay, the Pope. They view him as holding together the Christian world while it went through the darkness of these terrible barbarians ruling over it. Okay. So that's where it sits. With the infestation of the Longobards, the Pope had to look for a secular help and support from somewhere. He's got to try to figure out how to get back, you know, in some sort of position of power to really rule over things. And so the Franks, who are the settlers of what we now know as modern France, you saw a few weeks back, you know, the where all of the, you know, barbarians migrated to. The Franks came out of like northern Germany. Their king was Clovis. And they moved down into France, and they became what is, you know, the progenitors of the modern French. But they were known as Franks back then. And Clovis was their king to begin with. Again, this is back in the late 400s and early 500s, where he was converted. That is, he was baptized Catholic. And he unified the barbarian tribes of France. Now, this is known as the Merovingian dynasty. Okay? Merovig was Clovis's father. And so while the Franks ruled in France, they were known as the Merovingian dynasty. And, you know, they were just, like I said, the progenitors of the modern Frenchmen. They ruled the kingdom for quite a number of years. But Clovis's sons and grandsons wound up being weaker leaders than were needed to really rule things well. And so, and this is going somewhere, just hang on. So, because the sons and grandsons were weak, there's something that developed, and instead of the kings of the Franks actually ruling, they developed an office in the capital there in France, where it wasn't the kings that ruled, it was the mayor of the palace. Now, this is like a protectorate where, since the kings are weak, they kind of allowed themselves to become symbolic, while the real power, the guy that goes out and administrates, runs the government, and fights the battles, is called a mayor of the palace, okay? And it's like a Cromwell's protectorate in England in the 1600s, if you know anything about that at all. But basically, you have now a king and a figurehead king. The real king is the mayor of the palace. The figurehead king is family. It's like the king of England doesn't have much power. It's parliament, right? So it's like that, a little bit like that. Anyway, these were the guys that the Pope had to schmooze and you know, jockey with to get power back. And at this point, the Pope is still confirmed. He's still technically under the Byzantine emperor, but that's going to change. There's a guy that shows up. He's the first mayor of the palace. His name is Pepin of Heristal. And Pepin is the first mayor of the palace. This is, again, this is now around the 700-year AD time frame. Now, things flow together. So at this point, you're past 600. Remember that Muhammad rose up around 610 or so and started his stuff. And so by the time you're into the 700s, and I have no map, so I'm sorry, but from down in Arabia, Muhammad has come up and captured the Holy Land, Palestine, and he's fighting in Turkey, but he's also done this pincer movement. So he moves west, he's defeated Egypt, he's come across North Africa, defeated North Africa. He's even jumped the Strait of Gibraltar And he is now fighting in Spain. And so they have a major thing that they're facing there. This causes great upheavals in Europe. And the Europeans are facing the possibility of getting smashed between the two pincers as the Mohammedans move in and smash into each other. So by the 730s, Islam is threatening the Western Europe as well as the Catholic Church, the ruling French, and the popes as well. And here comes Pepin's son. His name is Charles Martel. His nickname is Charles the Hammerer. He is a great military leader. And so in 732, again, he is the illegitimate son of Pepin. He's the mayor of the palace. He's the next mayor of the palace. And just south of Paris in a place called Tours, France, in 732, he finally met the Muslims and drove them back so that they got no further than that going eastward. Now, as days go by later in history, the Muslims are still beating on Turkey's door and stuff, and they have to be beaten back over there, but that's not to this point yet. So Charles Martel, Charles the Hammerer, he's the mayor of the palace, so he's technically more or less the king in France. And so he's just saved Western Europe, and he's saved, of course, the Pope's backside and Roman Catholic Christianity. And so so now under the French, the Pope recognizes the fact that if he can sidle up to the mayor of the palace in France, he might have somebody whose power he can ride and do something with. As it turns out, that's exactly what he did. He calls Charles Martel in, and he bestows upon him the title of patrician and consul of Rome. This is an Italian pope calling a French king, a mayor of the palace, the patrician and consul of Rome. He's saying that the patrician, a protector, that he's the protector of the Roman Catholic Church and of Rome. And he's basically crowned him, you know, of himself. It's none of his business. This is just a Frankish king. This is just a French king. But, okay, Charles the Hammerer dies, and he's the father of a guy named Pepin, another Pepin. Pepin the Great, or Pepin the Short. And I looked it up, and nobody knows why he was called the Short. They don't think he was that short, like Napoleon. They think that it had to do with the fact that he was probably, you know, here's Big Pepin, there's Little Pepin. One of those deals. Anyway, it's Pepin the Short. And this is, again, the son of Charles Martel. He's the next mayor of the palace. And Pepin decided that since he was mayor of the palace and the proper kings of the French weren't doing anything anyway, that he should be both. And so he kind of rigged an election, and they elected him as both mayor of the palace as well as the king of the French, or the king of the Franks. He was elected, and Pope Zacharias comes in. This is the mid-700s, 750. Pope Zacharias comes in and decides that, you know, since Pepin has been elected, that he should be both mayor of the palace as well as king. He said, then that's perfectly fine with God. Now, here's an Italian pope in French politics telling the usurper of the French kings that he was good doing what he did. And besides all that, he entitles Pepin with, by the grace of God, he is the king of the Franks. And the Pope gave him the title Patrician of the Romans. So again, this is implying that that the French king is now responsible for protecting the Romans, in particular the Roman Catholic Church. So I know, so this is a bunch of politics, but here's some good stuff coming. Meanwhile, after this happens, those pesky Longobards or Lombards come back into Italy and are starting to make trouble again. And so Pepin the Short crosses the Alps and protects the Pope's concerns there and defeats the Lombards and drives them back. And then he did something very interesting. He gave the Pope land. This is called the Donation of Pepin. So he comes in and runs the Lombards off from the land they'd captured. And since he is the patrician to the Romans, here's a Frankish king in Italy, and he wins a battle against the barbarians, and then he gives the Pope the land that he captured. So he has just done something where he's bestowed upon the Pope, who's supposed to be just the pastor of a church, he's bestowed upon him like territorial conquest. The Pope is now a king. The Pope now owns land. Besides the land that people are dying and giving to him because they want to make sure they don't spend any more time in purgatory than they have to. And so Pepin makes this quote-unquote donation, and boy, all kinds of things follow from there, because remarkably, about this same time, there's a series of documents that come out of nowhere, and this is called the Donation of Constantine. Now, I hope this is not too uninteresting to you, but Pepin wins land and gives it to the Pope. The Pope now owns territory. Okay, at the same time, there has been a story that's developed through the years that when Constantine became the emperor of Rome. Now, when did Constantine become emperor? This was back in the 330s, right? Well, we're now up in the 750s. So we're talking about 400 years. For 400 years, there's been this story that's circulated, and I don't know who started it, but I can probably guess, that the Emperor Constantine had actually been a leper, and that he had gone to the Bishop of Rome back in that day, I'm talking about 350 AD or less, and he had gone to him, and he had been healed of his leprosy and actually converted to Christianity that way. Okay? And so Constantine was so grateful to the bishop in Rome, the Pope one day to be, that Constantine was supposed to have made this liberal land grant and rights to certain territories and given it to the Pope out of gratitude. Now, nobody knew about it until now. Strangely, at the same time, in that same writing, Constantine declared that the church at Rome was to have precedence and preeminence above all other churches, and that the Roman bishop was the supreme bishop over all churches. So the donation of Constantine was real. That was real land that he won and gave over to the Pope. The donation of Constantine is a fraud. This is a story the Catholic Church made up over 400 years, and one day somebody magically shows up with the documents that say that Constantine had been healed of his leprosy and converted to Christianity, baptized by the Pope, and so he gave the Pope a bunch of land, and also said, "Again, hey, guess what? You are the bishop of all bishops. You are the head of all churches." Is anybody feeling a certain suspicion about this? Because anybody can make up the documents, right? They probably got it off YouTube. I don't know. But Constantine is then, we all know that Constantine left Rome and moved the capital city to Constantinople. He called it Constantinople after that, right? It turns out that according to the Donation of Constantine, the reason that Constantine left Rome to go to Constantinople was that he withdrew so as not to interfere with the Pope's imperial rights. So the king of the empire just moves to Constantinople so he can leave, you know, the Pope to do his thing, because he is, after all, the head of all churches. So that is called the Donation of Constantine. And so what I hope you can see is that the Pope lied and maneuvered his way into a circumstance where he could use a king and ride that king's coattails to power. And then he forged documents, and they believed the documents. And so now suddenly he is not only a spiritual ruler, he's also a territorial ruler. So that's just, it's a remarkable story. Now, the guy that followed Pepin the Short, Pepin the Great, was a guy named Charlemagne. Charles the Great, or Charles der Grosse, was one of his other names in a different language. But he was Pepin's kid. He was of great administrative and military ability. And he, by the way, stepped up and confirmed his father Pepin's donation of land to the Pope. And so Charlemagne was a tremendous king. He led 52 different military campaigns. He was a great administrator, a very talented man. Some people have tried to, you know, entitle him as the Moses of the Dark Ages. He weren't no Moses. But the bottom line is the Pope found another king to ride the coattails of all the way to power. I wanted to read you some stuff about Charlemagne. Let me see if I can find the page. Okay. Charlemagne is one of the great prototypes of all Roman Catholic dictators. Charles conducted more than 50 military campaigns against various tribes and barbarian tribes in Europe. This was done in an attempt to unite all the Teutonic and Latin people in Europe into essentially a united nations under himself, as well as a Roman Catholic Pope. Charlemagne was nearly 7 feet tall, if not more, with a commanding presence. He was fond of hunting and swimming. During his meals, he had Augustine's City of God read to him instead of the Bible. Among his more outstanding private enterprises was limiting his concubines to only 4 after the death of his 5th wife. He also took measures to correct every old Latin version in Europe with Jerome's Latin Vulgate. None of the popes opened their yaps about Charlemagne's 4 dismissals of his wives that he didn't like. When a field commander has as large an army at his disposal as Charlemagne had, convictions about divorce become highly flexible and sometimes are simply swept under the rug. But that's Charlemagne. However, one of the greatest events of the life of Charlemagne was this. Pick up the story here. In 800 AD, Pope Leo III fled to Charlemagne's court after nearly being killed in factional fighting again of the barbarians in Italy. And so Charles goes back with Leo III to Rome and runs Pope Leo's enemies off. And so it's on Christmas Day of 800 that he is in the palace worshiping, and Leo comes in behind him and puts a crown on his head. And while he's kneeling in prayer, and everybody in the church, the Catholic Church in Rome, shouts, "Charles Augustus crowned by God." And so there Charles becomes the king over both France as well as the Roman Catholic Church. And so when they said crowned by God, who put the crown on his head? Leo. And Leo is the vicar of Christ. He was crowned by God. That's like Leo saying, "I'm God." And so out of all that basically came the idea, you know, of, you know, the Pope being the ruler of the spiritual kingdom and the emperor being the ruler of the physical kingdom, that kind of deal. And that's the basically how the Dark Ages ran, with the popes, you know, manipulating kings to get power. Remember, he has the power in Catholic nations to interdict them. If the king's not doing what he wants, he can interdict them. He can say, none of your people in France or wherever can take communion, and they won't get last rites, and we won't marry them in the Catholic Church, and we won't bury them in a Catholic cemetery. And those people are effectively de-Catholicized, and the people ain't going to stand for it, so the king has to then knuckle under. And so there's become, what this sets up is this constant conflict between the kings of Europe, whoever, you know, was Catholic, and the Pope, who became their superior spiritually, because he rules the spiritual kingdom and they rule the political kingdom. They fight the battles, but he has access to the army. That's how this all plays out, and that's where it all wound up. Charles finally, you know, Charles dies. His grandsons wind up dividing the kingdom among themselves. One of them gets France, one of them gets Germany, and another of them got a 1,000-mile strip, a tract between the two places. And the kingdom kind of fell into anarchy after that point, and that led to feudalism. Feudalism, not futile, but feudalism. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But so we've been talking about the Pope having gained territory. He really didn't lose that territory until after 1800. Until after 1800, the Pope actually was the ruler over quite a lot of territory. And finally, in 1870, Victor Emmanuel took possession of Rome as the capital of a free United Italy. And since then, the Pope has not technically owned land except for the Vatican grounds. But starting in 700 AD, the Pope had all kinds of land that he was also the king of, effectively. So again, this is just a very corrupt system. You know, historians view the demise of Charlemagne's kingdom after it all split up as unfortunate. We see them as the judgment of God on a corrupt Christianity. Anyway, so we brought up feudalism. Let me talk to you for just a little bit about that, see how far we can go here. Feudalism was the result of, like I said, the Roman imperial empire breaking up. And then a couple of kings who had been very powerful, yet failing, and things split and divided and all that kind of stuff. And so feudalism, it's where all central political control dissolves. And so people have to go back to the land. It's basically built around the landowner. So the lord, we call them landlords today. It means the guy owns the property, right? Okay, the lord is the landowner. And the knight is the military protector of the land that the landlord, the lord, hires. Then you have serfs and peasants that are just laborers and farmers. And people are stuck in this system because you don't just go from being a serf or a vassal. You don't a serf or a peasant to being to moving up the ladder. You're stuck in poverty for your whole life. The fourth the fourth part of the feudal system is the priests. You have the lord who owns the land, the knights who fight for the land, the farmers' laborers, the serfs and peasants. Then you have the priests. And, you know, the Pope at this point still owns a bunch of land because people are dying and, again, trying to keep themselves out of purgatory. So they're giving him a bunch of land, as well as Pepin's giving him land. And Constantine, it was a faker. It was fakery, but people believed it. And so he has all kinds of territories that he's got. And so he can play this whole landowner bit himself. All this was basically medieval mafia. Separate tribes and families of landowners controlled what they could and were strong enough to keep. They made crops and they hired people, and the people came in and, you know, they fed themselves and filled the landowner's coffers with the money he could sell it for. The priests controlled a whole bunch of things, like whether or not people went to heaven or not, how long they stayed in purgatory, and those sort of things. So it was just a really dark, dark time. Much of the land was owned by the church, who, penitent men who didn't want to spend time in hell or purgatory would give away their land and their manors so that the Pope could pray them out of purgatory. So it doesn't take much of an imagination to grasp the vice and the corruption that set in. And so the feudal system was just this hopeless, dark, dark time. And so when you hear it in context, it's just a time where nobody could get a better job. They were just stuck where they were. The priests held great power because they had the power to deny somebody, for instance, the sacraments. So they controlled somebody's salvation. The landowners just had the land. The military guys just fought, and everybody else just survived. And so that was feudalism. And we'll close here, I think, because I can't possibly open with the next thing. Basically, a general survey of Thyatira ends with, you can call it 1054. It's roughly 1,000 years, at 1000 AD. But in 1054, the Eastern Church split from the Western Church, and the Western Church being the Roman Catholic Church, the Eastern Church being the Greek Orthodox Church, the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, the Russian Orthodox Church. They split, and we'll talk more about why later, but everything got split down the middle, and so to this hour, that split still stands. You still have Roman Catholics, you have Ukrainian Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, and all those sort of things. That split at the end of Thyatira at 1000 AD. Now, like I said, all that was to try to give you a sense of, you know, all of the politics and the names and stuff, was to try to give you a sense of how the popes played the game and got in a position that they wound up in with all the power and all the money, and still had the say. They were the rulers of the spiritual kingdom, and the kings were supposed to be rulers of the physical kingdom. But because the popes held their people in their sway, the popes could blackmail them into using their armies to do what the popes wanted. And if the king didn't do what they wanted, they could, under the right circumstances, interdict his people so that nobody in their country could stay saved. And the people aren't going to put up with that. And so he actually learned to control the kings. And that's what he did for the better part of 2,000 years. Or 1,000 years. Questions? Yes, sir?